And for the next couple of days, I am going to be discussing with you my experience with the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have done this before, and I usually start off by entering a disclaimer. I am not here, I don't consider it my function to be here as a teacher, teach anybody anything about anything. Nor do I consider it my function to explain to you what's in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a very simple book, it's in the English language, and you can all read it. And I don't have any particular insight into that book that's any different than anybody else's. The one thing I come here with is experience. I am an experienced member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have been a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous since November the 24th, 1965. And in those years since then, except for the usual emergencies, etc., it is fair to say that I have been at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every day. And the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that I attend on a regular basis are step meetings. So I have, what I bring to this gathering is experience. And as Don read in our preamble, that is what we share here. We share our experience, our strength, and our hope. I have opinion on everything. I have opinions on all types of things. I try not to share my opinions with you. I will, I'm sure. But my opinions are well-informed opinions. And I will die defending them, etc., etc. So if you hear me giving opinions, you'll just have to excuse me because that's the way I am. And if I end up preaching to you, that's the way I am. So I don't mean it to be that way, but that's the way it oftentimes comes out. I am required by form to tell you that I do not speak for Alcoholics Anonymous, and then what I tell you is just what I think. Secretly, I don't believe that. I am telling you gospel truth here. It should suffice for the whole fellowship. Unfortunately, I am bound by a lot of traditions, so I have to say that as a matter of form. As I say, I've been here a long time, and you can tell by looking at me, I've been someplace for a long time. And I don't talk about drinking very much because I don't think it has very much to do with it. Like everybody else, when I came here in 1965, I came here the first time in 1963, and I lasted 10 months, and I was not successful. I got drunk, and I experienced being drunk after having been to AA for 2 years between 63 and 65. And when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous the second time, I came here with a much different approach than I had the first time. Because between 1963 and 1965, I demonstrated to my own satisfaction what powerlessness over alcohol was. And it was the most devastating thing that had ever happened to me. And as this book says, I was reduced to just a pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. That's what the book says. And that's the way I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1965. I'm sure that I came here so that I wouldn't drink it. But over the years, my learning and my experience such that I don't consider that I'm here not to drink. That's not why I'm here. And if you're new, and I understand there are some people here new, that's our first rule, and maybe it's our only rule, and that's don't drink. Go to the meeting. And don't drink in between meetings. But there is much, much more to Alcoholics Anonymous than not drinking. Go to the meetings. Not drinking and going to meetings is vital. It's as breathing is to living. But there's a great deal more to life than just inhaling and exhaling. And I found that out, and my thoughts about the program are constantly changing. The last period of time, say the last several years, what I've I've come to understand for my own purposes is that Alcoholics Anonymous, for me, nothing less than a search for a relationship with God of my understanding. And it may be different things for different people, but that's what I have been pursuing now for the last period of time that I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I say, that's a much different approach than ever I had when I first came. There was a period of my life when before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, where I had been very successful at a very young age, as are many alcoholics. And one day I was sitting there and I had it all. I mean, I had the whole thing. I had it all together. And the next time I looked around, everything was gone. And I wondered where the hell it went. Because it was there. The last time I paid any attention to anything, there it was. And it was gone. And I was sitting there and I was in a complete state of terror. And I lived in that state of terror for some period of time. And I used to sit in this big chair. I had a house. I had a wife. I had 7 children. I had a license to practice law. I had already been fired from a career job as a teacher of law. In 1962, that's why I came to AA the first time. And now it was 1964, and I'm sitting in this house, this big chair, and I have a bottle of vodka. And I'd watch the television many times it was on. And I would drink and I would brood. And I'd be in terror, and then I'd brood some more. And then I'd set fire to the chair because there's the smoke. But the chair didn't burn because I also had taken a leak in the chair. So it would smolder and it would smell, but it would never burn. And I would sit there in that dirty old chair, brooding, worrying, and planning my revenge. And thinking to myself, someday, you know, very soon too, someday, I'm going to get out of this chair. I'm going to get some dry clothes. I'm going to get a typewriter, you know, and they'll hear from me, boy. They'll hear, I'll be there. They'll hear for those guys that push me around. They'll hear from me. And I would contemplate what kind of an action I would bring, you know, something exotic, mandamus, or some stupid thing like that. And every once in a while, I'd have to go vertical and search for money. So I was very active practicing continuances and adjournments, and I had a patented all-purpose affidavit that I would flog around in various places. And I was like cornucopia. All the work would come in to one end, and nothing would come out the other end. It was just like cornucopia in reverse. Until the day that I showed up, and I don't think it was the drinking that brought me here. I mean, I knew about the drinking. Long time before I came to AA, that was no news to me that I was an alcoholic. I knew. Everybody in my family was alcoholic. That was not news. I think I could have drank some more. I was 37 years of age. My older brother lasted until he was 48. My uncles and my cousins usually died between 45 and 50. I'd been to the funerals. I knew about my family. I knew all about this stuff. And I think I could have hung on a little more and drank. But what I could not take was the terror. And that's what got me. Fear. And my fear amounted to terror. Very, very bad. It almost immobilized me. So I called a longtime friend of mine who was also a lawyer and a longtime member of this program. And I talk about him a lot. His name is John, and he's my sponsor. He now is retired and lives in Ireland in his retirement. So I don't see him very much, but we correspond back and forth. And I asked him if he would help me. And he said he would. If I would not drink and go to the meetings. And so I began that way. And it's been a constant evolution ever since. And I was brought to the steps of this program, which is what we're going to talk about, very early by John. He was and is a very orthodox member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's a very big book-oriented member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was forever sticking my nose in the book. And he used to tell me over and over again, if it's not in the book, it's not important. And if you have to know something, he said, it will be in, this is the book. It'll be in the book. If it's not there, it's not important. We had a guy up there, a very smart guy. He was a research chemist and also a physician. And he worked for Sloan Kettering. He was very smart. Donald, remember? Marty, remember? Very, very smart guy. Marty had come in a little before I did. And I admired him. And I sort of identified with him like he had 4 months. We had people there with 10, 15 years. They frightened me. But 3 months, my kind of a guy. And besides, he looked all right. I guess he went to college because he had all these jobs and degrees. Not like the guy that drove the Schaefer beer truck who ran the group. You know. Really want to associate with him. And one day I showed up and Marty said to me, it's capillary. I said, tell me again. He said, capillaries. The whole thing is capillary. He said, I figured it out this afternoon in the lab. All capillaries. Alcoholics have something dangerously wrong with their capillaries. And that sounded good to me. Doesn't that sound all right? Capillaries. I said, holy. And John showed up. And I said, John, Marty says it's capillaries. And played it very cool. He said, get the book. So I went over and I came back with the book. He said, find the part about the capillaries. So I said, I don't think it's in there. He said, then it's not important. He said, listen, even if Marty is right, it's not important. He said, I'm not telling you Marty's wrong. I don't know the first thing about chemistry. I'm not a chemist. He said, but even if he's right, it's not important. Because if it were important, it'd be in there. He said, if you have a problem that's not in that book, then it's not important. And it took a while for me to understand what he was talking about. And I would come, you know, the way we are in first beginnings. I would whine. You know, alcoholics are wonderful people. They come here, as I did, unemployed and unemployable. Correct? 6 months later, they're underpaid and their boss is an asshole. And he'd say, is there anything about that law firm in that book? I'd say, no, well, it's not important. Oh, it takes a little while when you're new, you know, to get. I have the usual whine about my wife and my children. He said, look, you know, there's nothing in there about that. It's not important. I thought it was important. Yeah, don't worry about it. And I would have all of these problems, and he would say, it'll work out. I said, well, how do you know that? And he said, I don't. But it will. Yeah? And it was an odd thing, as you have experienced your own self. What he said to me was true. It's always true. It always. He said, don't worry about it. So I worried about it. I worried about it and worried about it. And then it solved itself the way things do. And I thought, what was I worried about? Then I'd find something else to worry about. And I don't know when that all, you know, finally went away. And one time somebody else was at the group. And they said, as you hear oft times, they were having trouble with the spiritual part of the program. John, who was very mild-mannered, never used bad language, the opposite of me. He got very exercised. And on the way home, I said, what's the matter? He said, where do these assholes come from? I don't know. I think he said he was from Yonkers. He said, there is no spiritual part of the program. And that got my attention. I said, there isn't? No, the whole thing is spiritual. There's nothing you can pull out and say, this is the spiritual part. This is, you know, you pull out the sixth step, say, see, that's spiritual. But you pull out the fourth step, say, that's not spiritual. He said, the whole thing is spiritual. I thought the first step had something to do with drinking. Which is not a bad thought. especially if you knew him. But the way he explained it to me, it doesn't have anything to do with drinking much. He said, look what it says. It says, we. First word. It said, you have never been connected with anybody for your whole life. Right. He said, you've never been part of a we. And that was true. He said, you've always been by yourself. And that was true. I don't know if this is true in your life, but it was true in mine. I suffered from a very, very early age, I mean early, first grade, from a sense that I didn't belong. You know what I mean? I just didn't belong there. I didn't know anything about school or church or any of that stuff. I was 5 years old. My oldest sister took me up to school, dropped me off. I found out I was an Irish Catholic. I didn't vote on that. The first Friday I was in grammar school, my sister made me a bologna sandwich. Catholics didn't eat meat in those days on Friday. I pull out a bologna sandwich. The nun tries to take the bologna sandwich. I'm into a fist fight with a nun. my fifth day in school. With her, it's a big theological point. With me, it's lunch. I'm rolling on the floor with a sister of mercy. And she won, and I didn't get any lunch, and I was Raymond the Heretic from then on. And it was a goddamn hassle. And I went through all through school. Everything was a hassle. Because I didn't belong. And that followed me all through my life. And even though I had that feeling, it was very strong. Even though I was successful, you know what I mean? I was successful. I was a successful kid. I had a lot of friends. I was terrific at school. Not only was I the smartest guy in the school all the time, but I was also president of my class all the time. I'm still the president of my law school class. I get along with people. I'm all right. And I had a great job. In 1958, I was the youngest tenured professor of law in the United States of America. Guys, my class in law school figured I was a star. You know, they expected great things. And I lived in the right town. I moved into a town called Larchmont, New York. Right kind of a town. Right kind of a house. Everything. The right car and the right club and the right. And I never, ever felt like I belonged. And I'd be some bar. On 2nd Avenue in Manhattan, 4 o'clock in the morning, drinking. And the guy next to me would be spitting on my shoe, trying to steal my change off the bar. And I'd be thinking to myself, I don't belong here. You know, I'm a law professor, for Christ's sake. I don't belong here. And I had a beautiful house up there with a den and all that stuff. I didn't want to go up there because I didn't feel like I belonged up there either. So I wasn't. You know, I didn't belong in a saloon, I didn't belong in my house, I didn't belong in the club I belonged. And I suffered that. I found out later what caused it. It's part of alcohol. But he was right. I had never been part of a we. Never. I grew up that way, I grew up, I just found out about 4 years ago my family was dysfunctional. I didn't know about that, but I found it out. All I know is my father died when I was 2 and I had an alcoholic mother, so you grew up the best you could. And all the rest of it. And I just never felt. I was never part of it. Didn't belong to it. I was very good by myself, you know. Still am, I don't mind. But I was never really part of anything, and he told me that. So for you to be part of a group, spiritual thing, because you're acknowledging need all these people to help. And the group I joined at that time, very small, we had maybe 9 people, 10 people. Just a little bunch. We sat around a chair Wednesday night. Said to all these people, you asked them to help. You want to know something? You asked him. He was in a different group. Said, they'll tell you. Well, you got to be part of it. So I became part of the we. That's the spiritual. The admission of powerlessness The book says that we can see this through our innermost self. Our innermost. This magnificent body that you're now looking at, this is my outermost self. The innermost self is spirit. Not the blood, bones, stuff shown on X-ray. The innermost self is the spirit that each of us have. That what is what we really are in our spirit. You know, our bodies have all taken beating over the years, but it repairs itself. Well, it doesn't, but that spirit stays. And that's where the concession of powerlessness is made, according to our book. Indeed, your innermost self. Alcoholics have lost the power of choice when it comes to alcohol. That concession has to be made this way, spiritually. Doesn't make any difference what I tell you, does it? We're all lawyers. I can tell you anything. What difference does it make what I tell you? Or what you tell me? I can admit to the whole world I'm an alcoholic. If I don't concede to hear, I used to tell people in bars before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that I was alcoholic. That was my defense half the time. When the bartender said, for Christ, you know, what the hell's wrong with you? They listen, Mike, I'm an alcoholic, all right? Yeah, but that's his wife. I know. That was my defense. And where I grew up, if alcoholism was a defense, it wasn't a mitigation, it was an absolute defense. So what the hell did he do that for? He was drinking. Oh, well, that's all right. The Irish culture, you know? Why, he shouldn't have done. The man was drinking. Ah, perfectly. Complete defense. So the admission of powerlessness I take to be a spiritual thing. And it was not an easy thing for me to do. It took me 3 years to get a year. I was not successful. I did not concede to my innermost self. And I was an alcoholic. I came here the first time, I guess. I came to get out of trouble. And I got out of trouble. Once I got out of trouble, then I didn't need this anymore. So I got drunk. And I was not part of a group the first time. I didn't have a sponsor the first time. I learned. The book tells me that someone like me has to be beaten into a state of reasonableness. What's that? That's what happened. Alcohol just beat me into a state of reasonableness. And for me to admit my life was unmanageable, I think it's saying the same thing twice. If you notice in the first step, there is no connecting word there. It doesn't say we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives were unmanageable. It just got this little zip in there. Hyphen, I guess you call it. Or a dash or something. I think they're saying the same thing twice. I think. The unmanageability of my life resulted from my powerlessness over alcohol. And my powerlessness over alcohol resulted in an unmanageable life. I think it's all the same. And my life was unmanageable in the true sense. I could not manage it. That's it. It wasn't a question of houses and cars and money and all of that. I just couldn't manage. I mean, everything was unmanageable. I would spend a half hour getting dressed, you know, just a hassle. My God, oh, now you gotta tie shoes. Jesus, what next? I'll go down to the kitchen, have a drink over this one, now come back up. One year I ran around loafers, bolt clip-on ties. Imagine a slick guy like me with a clip-on tie. Because I couldn't manage. It was just they should have had a keeper for me. And ultimately they did. And of course, you know, we describe this in our program in a variety of ways. And the 12 and 12 is very clear on this. It says that not much good is going to come to one of us unless we've arrived at that bottom. They call it a bottom. And when I speak around, and those of you who have listened to the tape have heard this, I say this because I think it is true. I say that there's a time for all of us. And I think there is a time for each of us. I say that there is a line somewhere beyond which just simply. And it seems to me that there is a point somewhere below which we simply are not permitted to sink. And it also seems that there is a level of pain somewhere beyond which no human is required. And I don't know where this line is. I only know what happened. And I think this is different in each case. We all come to it in our own time, in our own way. But the destination is come to the end of it. As I did. Where the only thing left is to become a member here, part of this thing, part of Alcoholics Anonymous, part of the we. And the beginning moves are very, very simple. You come here, don't drink. You become a member of a group of Alcoholics Anonymous. You get a sponsor. And I just read, as I read the beginning of the fifth chapter tonight, rarely have we seen anyone fail who has thoroughly followed our path. What is a path in this beautiful location where we are here? If I see over there a way made through the woods here, I know when I see that, that other people who have used this facility have gone that way. And their steps have created the path. Correct? And if I, here I am, temporarily from Michigan, if I want to take that path out there, the smartest thing I could do is to find somebody who's been along the path. He knows, or she knows. Some parts of the path may be a little tricky, a little more difficult than other parts. It gets narrow, it gets wider, it gets deeper. And more importantly, I spoke to one of these nice ladies around here, the Presbyterian ladies, who know the path, they could show me the way. They know where it comes out. They know it's at the other end of that path. And so I had this sponsor. And I followed him. I put my steps behind his. Every step of the way. And we went on. By not drinking, by not going to meetings. By being a member of a regular group, by having a sponsor. I was able to say, as I am now, that I am powerless over him. I have no power. It isn't a question of drinking too much or too little or differently or someplace. It has nothing to do with it. I just have no power over this stuff. You know, if you read that first step a certain way, it says, if you read it a certain way, it says that you cannot stop drinking. You can't. You have no power. You're powerless over it. You can no more stop than fly to the moon. I could not stop. I would tell myself, I gotta stop, I'm going to. Very soon. Let's see, I have 3 quarts left, but very soon I will stop. Because I didn't want to be that way. I didn't want to be that way. I didn't want to be. I wanted to be a good lawyer. I really did. I was the smartest and best in my law school class. Why shouldn't I be a good lawyer? Everybody else thought I was going to be a good lawyer. And I wanted to be. I wasn't. I wasn't any kind of a lawyer at all. I was a fraud. I wanted to be a good husband. Yes. At least I didn't want to get caught not being a good husband. As I always was. Because I was an incompetent. I guess I wanted to be a good father. But I wasn't. And I would try, I gotta do something about it. But I could never get it together. Well, if I just have 2 more drinks, then I'll be strong enough to stand up vertically. I'll have 2 more and I'll get dressed. I'll just we'll take it easy today by that time. 9 o'clock in the morning and I already had a half a quart. I couldn't marry. But now I found myself here. I found myself on a path. I had the sponsor. I had the group. I was going to meetings every night because of my sponsor. I remember one time walking, the way we walk. He called me up. He said, Thursday we're going. So it's in such a place. I said, I can't go on Thursday. There was that little pause, you know. He said, is that because you never drank on Thursday? I said, what time are you going to be here? I would tell him, he just wouldn't let me get away with any of this. And now I found myself in Alcoholics Anonymous. See, all of this is very hard to reconstruct. It's just too long ago. So these dates I give you are not the result. I don't know what. Convenient for the story. Here I am with about 6 months, I guess, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wanted to drink every day. The obsession to drink had not gone away. Every day I wanted to drink, but I was afraid to drink. Because I knew what happened when I drank. I was just scared to death. I would go back there. Couldn't do that. The terror was right there. He used to say to me, the tiger is still in the woods. Don't go into the woods. That's where the tiger was. I knew it was there. And I had gotten a job. I worked in Manhattan. I lived in a place called Larchmont. I had to take a train going to Grand Central. So I went in this morning and I wanted. Up to then, I wanted to drink very, very badly. This morning, I got on the train, went into Grand Central. My office connected to Grand Central. I got on the train, walked over through Grand Central, up the elevator, sat down in my room, and I just sat in my chair, ordinary morning, and it hit me. I didn't want to drink. I had not thought about a drink. All the time I've been awake, like an hour and a half, 2 hours. I hadn't thought about a drink. I used to drink in Grand Central, great place to drink, many saloons. And I used to go, I knew all the bartenders. It never occurred to me to have a drink. So, holy shit. So I called him up. He was downtown, Wall Street. Large Wall Street firm. I said, I didn't want to drink this morning. He said, congratulations. And he hung up the phone. It was so astounding to me. It was so startling to me. I really said, holy shit. And I sat thinking. You know, the worst thing alcoholics can do in most cases is think. You should rip those signs down from all of our meeting rooms. I figured it out. My cool, analytical, finely trained, incredibly honed mind. I said, I live in the same place. I hang out with the same family. I'm working here. I ride the same train. I live in the same house. I see the same people. The only difference in my life is that I go to those meetings. I thought, holy shit. Must be something at the meeting. that works on people like me so that they don't want to drink. Power. Power. I came to that all by myself. Power. See, a lot of people start talking about the second step, and right away they're talking about God. I was at a meeting this afternoon here, and a lady talking about the second step, she got it all confused with God. They could have written the second step that way if they wanted to. Bill Wilson could have written that. We all came to believe in God. You know, he had enough clout that they probably could have got it through. He could have said we all became Presbyterian. Part of God's frozen people. And as we all know from our wonderful legal studies, the first rule of construction, when you're construing something is to look at the words. Read the plain meaning of the words, right? Basic rules of construction. It says, they came, it said, we came to believe that. You don't have to believe in anything. And the 12 and 12 is very clear in it. So there's no requirement you believe in anything. We came to believe that a power greater than our own, not a higher power, not God, a power with a capital P, admittedly, greater than our own could restore us to sanity. It's a statement of what happened. In my favorite pamphlet in Alcoholics Anonymous, a member's view of Alcoholics Anonymous, that author, great man that he is, starts off the pamphlet by saying that the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are a report of action taken. And in the 12 and 12, it says at the beginning, the thought of it, these are a group of spiritual principles, which, if taken, can make us happily and usefully whole. And this is what happened to these people who founded this program. They are telling us the action taken. The first thing they did, they said, first thing, what'd you do the first thing, Bill? He said, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives were in management. And if you had them on a witness stand, you would say, and then what happened? So you're not leading the witness, right? And he would say, well, we came to believe that a power greater than our own could restore us to sanity. And then what did you do? We made a decision. It's what they're telling us what they did. Now don't misunderstand me. We're going to get to God very shortly and probably never stop talking about it, but not now. Not in these early, early days with those people. This is what happened to me. I came here. I stopped drinking. I got a group, got a sponsor. And 6 months later, I didn't want to drink. And I thought, my God, that's power. It's exactly what I needed, because I just finished admitting and conceding to my innermost self that I was powerless. And the one thing that someone with no power has to have, power. And I believed it. Not because he told me about it. Not even because I read it in the book. I believed it because it happened to me. I experienced it. I no longer wanted to drink. But holy shit. I knew that I was not capable of that. Because I don't think there had ever been a day since I began drinking that I didn't want to drink. Sometimes I couldn't because of the service and you'd be on ships in the middle of the Pacific. It was a little harder to get a drink. It wasn't impossible, but it was just difficult. You make a decision, well, there's so much hassle getting in, I just won't. Yeah. But here I am, drinking became to me a non-event. Just like that. It just didn't count anymore. I wasn't for it. I wasn't against it. I just didn't give a shit about it. It just didn't register. And whereas before, if you said meet me at 1, I was there at 10 o'clock in the morning, because how can I trust you? You know, you're not reliable. I could get a court down before you showed up. Should we have a cocktail before lunch? Oh, why not? And I knew, you know, I knew that this had happened to me because of Alcoholics Anonymous and for no other reason. And I believed it because it happened. See, I was not a believer. Talking generally, I just wasn't a believer. My theology was, I don't give a shit. I would never get into a fight with some guy and argue about, is there a God, is there no God? I don't care. If there is one, fine. If there's not one, it's okay too. It had nothing to do with the way I lived. I was busy. Busy, busy, busy. All the time busy. I had to get up, dry up, throw up, get some money, find a place, get some dough to get the booze, worry about how I'm going to get the rest of the booze, get some more money, float a check, bounce a check. Busy, 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 all the time. And then we talk about theology. I had to worry about important things. Like, is that goddamn bar going to be open? Am I running a tab there? I was like everybody else, I was born to a religion. But I didn't vote on that. As I told you, I went to the first grade, I found out I was Irish and Catholic. Nobody asked me. So it was okay with me. That was the nearest school. And that's where they sent me. And you know, say in the first year, I don't want to go here. You know, first grade, I'd rather go to Harvard. I'd be whacking the head. But I never took what they said very seriously. I just didn't believe it. They would tell me all these things, and I would say, that's nice, but it had nothing to do with me. If they told me things not to do, that was the first thing I did. I was in the fourth grade in Catholic schools, and I have no complaint about Catholic schools. I was educated all the way through law school in Catholic schools. I never paid a dime's tuition. They were very good to me. I just didn't believe what they were telling me. Around the fourth grade, they told us about limbo. Remember limbo? All those babies that aren't baptized? Oh, I got very annoyed about that. I told her, no, that's crazy. You're nuts. There's no limbo. There's no babies floating around. Get out of your mind. Bang, bang, bang. Yeah. And I tell her, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard, limbo. Are you kidding me? I was very much against limbo. That was my first theological position. And then we got into the seventh grade, and they were dead against jerking off. And I was all for it. And I consulted my older brother. And he was all for it, too. Then I said, I can't pay any attention to these people. They're not in their right mind. I wasn't mad at them or anything like that. It just didn't interest me. They had all these rules. I didn't want to hear about them. Because everything they didn't like, I liked a lot. And I didn't rant and rave. I didn't go to church. It wasn't that I was mad at anybody. It just didn't interest me to go to church. I had more important things to do. I was a very busy person. And on Sunday morning, I'd zip over to the American Legion, a smother exclusive place like that, where they had bars on Sundays. Everybody else go to church. It was okay with me. Miss O'Keefe took all the children. That was wonderful. Got them out of the house. Fine. I just wasn't a believer. No, I didn't believe in that. From the Bronx in New York City, get a little cynical, get a little skeptical, don't believe anybody. That's the way I was. And I retain some of that now. So, when it came to believing here, the whole thing was different. Nobody told me that. Nobody gave me a lecture on it. Nobody showed me. It just happened that I didn't want to drink. Boy, that made a believer out of me. And it said it could restore me to sanity. That was okay with me. He pointed out to me that Jay Walker in the big book. And boy, I picked up on that one. You remember that guy? He goes across, he gets hit, he gets the broken arm, he goes across the next time, he gets hit, he gets the other arm, he gets the leg. And his friends are saying to him, don't jaywalk, Herman. Because every time you jaywalk, he get knocked down, and he's saying it's not the jaywalking, something else. And finally, the fire truck gets him killed. Right? And then the book says, just substitute alcohol. Isn't that the way we were? That was the way it was with me. I would drink, and I get all this trouble. I get thrown out, knocked down, fired, lose everything. And my friends would say to me, when I had friends, you drink too much. No, I don't drink. If you lived the way I live, you'd have to drink. You know, all those stories. Wasn't the drinking. Until I was beaten into a state of reason. And even then it wasn't the drinking. It was me. Me. One. Powerless. That was the beginning for me. And the answer to powerless is to have power. And all that required for me in the beginning was an open mind. I said to him, what is a power greater than my own? See, I saw that capital P. I thought they were going to sneak one. And he said, a power greater than your own. Is a power greater than your own? Very zen, huh? I thought for a minute that I was dealing with Moses. You remember when Moses had that discussion with the burning bush? Remember that? And Moses said to the burning bush, who are you? And the burning bush said, I am who I am. And Moses said, thank you for clearing that up. And that was the way he was. He said, it's greater than your own, a power greater than your own. Says it God? Could be. If you want it to be. Just power. He explained it that way. If they wanted the right God, they'd write God. You don't have to worry about anything like that. All you have to know is this is where the power is. And it is. It is. Alcoholics Anonymous, I now see it as a power center. What is it? What is it that we do here? Nothing physical going on. We don't have any leafy green vegetables. We don't have any aerobics. We don't have any diets. We sit around and we talk forever. And interminably. Yeah. About the same old thing. Powerlessness, power. What is that? You've had the experience, I'm sure, of trying to explain Alcoholics Anonymous to non-members. No way. Power. Power. So I stayed another period of time. And, of course, you know, I was the usual egomaniac, and I always thought I was very, very powerful. And sometimes, in my drinking career, I was powerful. Sometimes, I was given gifts that other men are not given. One time in the fall, during World Series time, and these are in the days when the New York Yankees had a baseball team, and the center fielder was a man named Mantle, who wore number 7 on his shirt, and I had showed up at about 9:30 a.m. to have lunch with a guy in a place. And he showed up around 1, and we had lunch, and he left. And I was still vertical, and I noticed that there was a baseball game. The World Series were on behind the bar, so I figured I would pass a few hours of the afternoon, take off of my busy schedule, and watch a game of the World Series. And I did. And I was watching, and Mr. Mantle came to bat, and I noticed 2 very curious things. First of all, I was seeing the picture in color, which had not yet been invented. And secondly, I could see right through Mantle's shirt. I could see the bones in his arm. I could see the muscles. I could see the tissue. I could see the hole inside of his shoulder. And I watched that, and I thought to myself, holy shit, I have X-ray eyes. So I mentioned it to the guy that was sitting next to me. A gentleman much like myself who was passing a few hours with a tumbler of scotch or something. And I told him, I said, you know, I can see right through Mel's shirt. I can see his bones and all his muscles. And he got up and he went away. So I got home that night, and my 9-year-old son was there, and, you know, of course he played Little League and all that. And I said, today, I could see through Mickey Mantle, and I explained this to my son, and he went away. And right then the phone rang, and she picked it up. Somebody on the other end must have said, what's new or something. She said, well, today he can see through people's arms. So I went away. And that is in a nutshell, the story of my drinking life, you know. I had all this ability and everything went away. Everybody. Until I was left with myself, which is the worst place. Now I have more than 6 months. I have 8 months, 10 months, whatever I have. And I'm floating along, you know. I never felt better. Now I'm a regular member of this group. I know where to put the car. I know where the coffee is. I know where the bathroom is. I know where the gurus sit, where I'm supposed to sit. I know everything. I'm all set. I'm fitting in. I like these meetings. I like the people. I haven't been able to say anything yet because they wouldn't let you do that up there. But I knew what to say if they would ask me. Nobody asked me anything. And he said to me one night, he said, it's time for you to make up your mind what you're going to do. What are you talking about? It's time for you to do the third step. Said, I know you've done one, and you tell me that you have experienced two, so obviously you've got to go on. And I'd seen it. You know, they're on the walls, and I'd seen it. And I'm a pretty quick book. I knew a wall of words. I knew what that was. I said, what, you know, what's all this stuff about will and giving your will to God and your life to God? No. There's nothing. I had heard people at third step meetings talk that way. They were all very saintly, I thought. These people were all turned over. They were sort of floating around. And God was handling a lot of the minutiae in their life, you know? Like whether they should get regular gas, the expensive kind of gas, whether they should go to the beach or go to the ball game, whether they should get married or not get married. God seemed to be running all these people's lives. I thought, pretty interesting people. So I asked him about that. I didn't know how that was going to work out with me. He said, no. There's nothing to do with that. Just look at the words of the step. And do what it says. Said, the first thing you have to do is make up your mind. Make a decision. The decision you have to make, he said, basically this, you're going to stay here. Or you're going to go back where you came from. Well, that's easy. I mean, that's easy. I knew where I came from. I knew what was back there. I knew about the terror. I knew what that was about. And there was no possible way I was going to. If I could help, there's no way. So I said, no, I want to stay here. He said, well, you got to make up your mind. I said, I made it up. I want to stay here. He said, then here's the next question. How will you live? Okay? Your will and your mind. How will you live? You're going to live that old way. Then you're going to get the same result. He said, we have a way of doing things. You're going to be with us, be part of the we. I want you to do things the way we do. That didn't seem so. And he said, now, among other things, he said, we pray around here. See, I know. Now we used to open the meeting, we closed the meeting, we were praying all the time. Atheists have a tough time in AA, they really do. I sympathize with them, you know? And I have nothing at all against them. And they get sober, don't misunderstand me, they get sober, fine, but it's an interesting phenomenon. Because they get, the ones I've met over the years, sort of militant about atheism. They come in and say, I'm an atheist and I don't go for this God stuff. I said, that's all right, Herman. Get a cup of coffee. Sit down. Relax. It's all right. Don't worry about it. Followed by the serenity prayer. He says, I'm an atheist and you're making me pray. I tell him, no. This is, you misunderstand. This is just the way we open the meeting. This is not a prayer. We're just opening the meeting. Oh, well, you're opening the meeting. And then we go through the meeting. Next thing you know, somebody's got him by the hand. He's going through the Lord's Prayer. He said, you make an atheist. No. That's how we close the meeting. Close the meeting that way. That's not praying. And then we kid them along. You know? So I see that staying in the second step. He said, no. That's power. Power has nothing to do with it. Like you think. Well, the third step they know because the G word is in there. So we tell them, don't get excited, Herman. It's God as you understand them. And you understand them not to be so. That's perfectly right. Don't worry about that. Yeah, but you know, I see a lot of that. Please, you know, by this time, of course, you see, the trick is we've sucked him in here for about almost a year. And he's not drinking. Things are getting better. He's getting better. And the job is working out. Money's coming in, you know. I'm pretty soon, I'll stick around. Then we don't really give it to him until around the fifth step. Where we call God by his maiden name, say, see, it was God after all, asshole. But by that time, we got him. So he said to me, you gotta make up your mind, how will you live? The old way is no good. I knew that. I mean, everybody. So, I noticed, I watched the words, Ted made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand. Well, as I told you, I didn't have a father. And I resented that very much when I was young. I really did. That really annoyed me. It pissed me off. I mean, everybody else had a father. I didn't have a father. They'd have these father and son things, you know. And some nice guy in the neighborhood would offer to take me, and I wouldn't go with him. I want to go anyhow. Fuck you, father and son. I resented that. But I didn't have a father. But I was a father. I am a father. I have seven. And I knew about being a father. Get experience. And I knew that at the end of these meetings, we said every night, our fun. That was a comforting notion to me. You know? So God, my understanding became then, and pretty much has been all this time, this concept of our Father. Our Father. Your Father, my Father. And this thought that a father would care for me made me feel good. And I knew the system of being a father. I went to school on my first kid. You know, and you learn as you go along. And in my career as a father, I don't know what I would guess I've been an average father. I have said no probably many more times than I ever said yes. You know, can I have a motorcycle? No. Well, how about going to Europe? Get the hell out of here, you know. No, goddammit, no. Every once in a while I say yes. And I knew when I told them no, that didn't mean I didn't like them. Didn't mean they weren't my kids. Didn't mean I didn't have a care for them. I just said, well, man, whatever this was no. I didn't tell them what to do. I didn't tell them how to live. I just sort of had a general supervisory role over them. I had control of the purse, which is always powerful. What the hell? I live in a house with 9 people. I was the only guy with a job. And so I sort of adopted that notion that this father that I had understood would care for me. And I liked that idea. I liked it. And I came here for help, you know. When I came first and second time, I came here asking someone to help. My sponsor didn't announce me. He was my sponsor. I had to go ask him. He was. I had to ask him for help. He told me he would help me, but I would have to follow his instruction. And I didn't see a great deal of difference in asking my sponsor to help in my initial days in Alcoholism. And asking our father to have a care for me. And what is that? What is that? When someone like myself, who is powerless, needs all the help he can get at all times, asks our Father to care for him. Prayer. What is it? Prayer. Communication. The God of my understanding. Any communication with God, as I understand the English language, is a prayer. And the book gives it to us that way. The book starts out right after what I read tonight. I was alcoholic and I could not manage my life. But hey, no human power is going to help me. And that's no human power. And that's me. And that's my sponsor. And that's all of you. No human power. No doctor. No group of doctors. No podiatrist, psychiatrist, psychologist, chiropractor. No human power. Nobody. Not Bill Wilson. Not Dr. Mahabha. No human power. It's so simple. And now you see in the last many years, the emergence of so-called treatment centers who are providing treatment for a disease for which there is no treatment. And they're hopeless. And they wonder why sometimes, and I tell them very easily. Sometimes I get asked to speak to these kind of people. I tell them, you're a human power. It isn't that you don't want to help. You just don't have the capacity to do it. Before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, every power greater than my own that I dealt with told me to stop drinking. The dean of the law school told me to stop drinking. Judges told me to stop drinking. She, who must be obeyed, told me to stop drinking. All my friends told me to stop drinking. All human power. And of course it was ineffective. And I couldn't stop. But when I came here, the power that was in those meetings at those days, that power removed from me the desire to drink. And that power was the power that I came to believe could help. And I transferred that power into God as I understand, which is my understanding, our Father. And I read before, as I read this beginning of the chapter, God has all power. All power. And then later on it says, no human power. Anyone who reads that as we do, and I hear it every night at meeting, it has to have its effect. Had its effect on me. And right after that, it says, see, God could and would if he was sought. The question then began to me. And that's when I began to get this glimmer. It was just a glimpse, I suppose, a glimmer. There was a great deal more going on around here than not drinking and going to meetings. I mean, I heard it over and over again. A lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, especially been here a while, they just don't seem to listen to that. People read that, but Jeff, I listen very carefully. It says, God has all power. May you find it now. And then right after A, B, and C, the next line says, being convinced. Being convinced of what? Of A, B, and C. I was convinced of A, B, and C. We were at step three. Just what do we mean and what do? It tells you right there. And then they say, start this way, that a life based on self-will can hardly be termed a success. Says that. I gave that a little thought. And you know, there was a time in my life when self-will, which I had an abundance of, was actually an asset, or I saw it as an asset. It was my will that got me out of that neighborhood in the South Bronx. That was my will. It was my will that got me into those schools. I will go to school, I told them. And, you know, I was in trouble. Time I was very small. And I was told, well, you know, in this family, you don't go to college. I said, I will go to college. When that was over, I came back and they said, da, da, da. I said, I will go to law school. When I went to the law school, I said, I will get on the law review and I will be a student here and I will be. And I was all of them. And I had to sit down and say, that's true. But it ran out somewhere along the line. It ran away. It went away. And I had to admit that my life was not a success. Oh, I had the usual stuff we all had on our walls. Yeah. That's not how I manage a life. I spent my 35th birthday in a mental institution. How manageable can I be, but Christ's sake. And it says a life based on self-will can hardly be termed a success. And I said, that's right. I was not a successful life. I was not successful in living. I was successful in achieving because I was born with certain talents. But I was not successful in a life. Because I just hadn't managed to accumulate any value. Substantial. It's all very, very shallow and meaningful. And this idea of a caring father appealed to me very much. And it says, and I take that to be a prayer, and the book says that most of us, or many of us, says, of course, the words are entirely optional. It's something like this. And I say this every day, and when I say it every day, I try not to do it by rote, because I've known it by heart from the earliest days. I say, I offer myself to you. Do with me and to build with me, as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I might better do you. Take away my difficulties, so that evidence of practice show those I would help. You hold on your power. May I do you. This notion I have of a fatherly power And I translate that into my own experience as a father. And many of us here are fathers. Imagine if one of your kids came up to you and said something like that, you'd have them put away. Imagine if a kid comes and says, hey, Pop, I offer myself to you today. I'll do anything you'd like me to do. Take away my difficulties, Pop, so I can be of help to you. Imagine one of your kids said that. Say, Pop, I have a hard time getting up for school tomorrow. Would you wake me up for school? Oh, my little Johnny. He's been possessed by spirits. And I think, perhaps, well, how do I know? How do any of us know in an area like this what's happening? But it comforts me to think. You know, I get comfortable thinking. There is this power as father of all of us. Here I am, and I'm telling him, listen, I'll do what you want. I don't want you. When you ask me to do it, I'll do it. Take away the stuff that keeps me from helping out. I'd like to be a good member of AA. To prayer. I have come to believe and come to think that practically all of us have prayers. One way or the other. If a prayer is a communication with this power, then all of our steps are that. Right. They're all prayers. They're all spiritual. Wasn't necessary for me to make a formal declaration of will or life or anything like that, or ask God, what would God do with my life? I don't think he's very interested in that. I mean, what would he do with it? Say, God, oh, Keith wants you to have his life. Oh, yeah? Well, bring him up here. Is he finished with it? He's not using it? Good. Tell him to come on up. I think this, and again, you know, this is what I think. We're in an area here. Well, your thoughts are as good as mine. I don't suppose I believe that either. Sort of patronizing. I think it's just the offer. Just the offer. Here we are, admittedly self-willed, egocentric to the extreme. Managed to just louse up everything we ever handled. Say things like this. See, I had this notion. Maybe a lot of people have it, I don't know, but I know I had it. I had this notion. I thought God lived in churches. I got that growing up and going to schools. I thought God was associated with churches. And if you wanted to talk to God, you went to church. And that's the way I was raised. You know, on Sunday morning, my mother, the widow, would wake us all up and march us over to church. We'd all sit there. And, you know, the guy would get up and he'd do his number and take a little snooze. And it was all over. And as you got older, you stood in the back of the church so you could run out when the bar's open at 1 o'clock. So I thought God lived in churches. And I thought there were groups of people in this world who had a, sort of a, an in, you know. And they knew how to talk to God. And so you went to them. You said, listen. I'm having a tough time. Talk to him and get me off the hook. And so I wasn't interested in churches. So I didn't have any contact with God. Because I didn't go to church. I still don't go to church. I'm not a member of the church. I don't count myself as a member. I'm baptized, I'm confirmed, I'm all of that. And so I just, you know. And I told that to John too. I said, listen, you know, I don't like church. I don't like anything about it. Music maybe, but I don't like the rest. He said, there's none of the old church. Well, God lives in a church. No, he doesn't. Huh. How do you know where he lives? I know. Give me that book. I brought over the book. And this is what describes me so perfectly. I am on every page of this book. Really am. Or at least I find myself there. Maybe I put myself there. Maybe I want to be there. So you pick up your book. Oh, there's O'Keefe. Listen to this. I'm sure you know this. But this really, really made an impression. And they're talking about people like me. Talking about people like me. And they're talking about people talking to people like me about God. Because they said God made these things possible. And we only smiled. So that was me. Some guys say God loves you, like God. You moron. Yes, he does. Now listen to this. This is a killer. Actually, we were fooling ourselves. For deep down, in every man, woman, and child, is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other, it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality with capital G and R. We found a great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there he may be found. It was so with us. And it was so with me. But this power, it turns out, which is all around us, generated by this program and no other program, this program, in the final analysis, is within us. And we cover it. I covered it over with pomp, self-gratification, self-delusion, vain glory, egomania. But deep down it's there. And you can fight it, if you will. And you can deny it. That won't change. There. It's in the spirit that makes each of us what we are. It was that spirit that alcohol almost killed. And that's why in Bill Wilson's correspondence with Dr. Jung, Jung makes the Latin play on words, spiritus, Latin, same word for spirit and for alcohol, spirit. That spirit, which is interior, alcohol can kill it, alcoholism. And that's why we say we have a spiritual illness. And that's why Alcoholics Anonymous works, because the medical profession, who are human powers, and I'm not knocking doctors, I'm not. Take them as a whole or individually, they are human powers. It isn't that they don't want to help. I had a physician when I drank. He wanted to help me. He didn't. He gave me Miltown. He gave me Librium. He gave me Valium. He gave me Stelazine. He gave me Thorazine. He wanted to help me. He really did. He liked me. I also was his lawyer. It wasn't that he didn't want to. He had no power. He didn't have the capacity. And he ended up doing all the wrong things. The dean of the law school, who made me resign that job, did not want to fire me. He and I became and are now very close friends. Although he's pretty sick. He didn't want to fire me. His wife told me, he said this, he was a wreck for a week after he got rid of my wife. He said, he had to do it. And he was right. I've told him since. I mean, I made all my amends. He wanted to help me. She, after all, here she is, very nice lady. She's stuck with this lunatic. She has 7 children. The oldest of whom is like 9. What? I'm the only guy with a job and I can't get vertical. What is she supposed to do? She's a nice girl. She has a college degree and all the rest of it. Not able to take care of that. I'm supposed to do that. Here I am, laying on the floor somewhere. It was very important to her that I not drink. For her sake, for my sake, because she had affection for me, has affection, and for the sake of her children. No power, no capacity. What could she do? Except what she did. I drank more. Oh, you know what it is? The more they leaned on me, the more I drank. They had my best interest at heart. It was never a question of that. It was never an issue that they didn't have my best interest at heart. The point is, they didn't have the power. They didn't have the capacity. The human power. So I come here, become a member of a regular group, go to the come to these rooms. Pretty soon I understand what my problem is. That I never had any power over that stuff in the first place. I understand that there's something here that's going to help me, a power. It isn't necessary for me to define it, put a name on it, or a face on it, or robes on it, or place it into some building. Just a power, man. Then I had to make up my mind. That I was going to be. Part of that power, be attentive to it, or not. So I asked that power. I asked our father. I told him, I want to stay here. I want to be. I offered myself. Here's a simple thing of the third step prayer. Show me. Show me. My own experience is that most times I know what to do. I really do. I know what to do. But many, many times I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to get the I don't know how to get from here to there. So I ask him to show me the way. And invariably, the last thing I'll say about these three steps, about this final notion of where this power is, you don't have to look very far. You don't have to. It's all around. It's in this room right now. I feel it. I hope. It's here. I assure you, it didn't come in you. It did not come in you. But you bring yours. And the we cement